Well, as the expression goes, these are the best of times, these are the worst of times. And the best of times, from a financial standpoint, we could definitely pat ourselves on the back as Americans, and in particular in this time, this day and age, and talk a little bit about the American standard of living. In 2015, the median household, median meaning there's an equal number on the top as there are on the bottom, it's not an actual average, but the median household income for the U.S. was a little over $56,000. So if you took every household in America, in every state, half of them are going to be more than $56,000 and the other half are going to be below $56,000. That's a fairly high standard of living. Now, you contrast that with the world. Now, we're not talking about the U.S., but if you contrast that with the world standard of living, that same figure, is under $10,000, $9,700 and change. So, you know, I have a friend who for many years has said to me over and over and over again, I just wish I had a little more. And when I would confront that person about, well, what's the definition of a little more? She would have a moving target, you know, a little more than we have today. Well, I happen to know something about their finances, and I would say, but you're you know, $3,000 or $4,000 more than you were last year. Isn't that a little more? You know, and probably $2,000 or $3,000 more than the year before that. Isn't that a little bit more? It's kind of interesting what we compare ourselves in South County. Now, that's a totally different comparison. And the second little paragraph I have there is that 1 in 10 people in the world today live on less than $2 a day. So if I handed you $2 and you had to feed, clothe, and transport yourself per day, $2, could you do it?
Not in this country.
Not in South County.
No.
You can buy a bus ticket. But, you know, 10% of the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. If you make more than $34,000 or $32,400 a year, you are in the top 1% of the world. $32,000. Top 1% of the world. Now, we immediately discount it because we look at the next number, which is in the United States, you'd have to make $450,000 a year to be in the top 1%. But think about that. If we took the average income of everyone sitting in this room, and you might be a bit of an anomaly looking around the room today, but a slice, let's take a slice of Stony Brook, we can do that. You're definitely a slice of Stony Brook, old or new, but at any rate, if we took the slice, the average South County income is probably between $150,000 and $200,000 a year. So that's going to put you in the top, what, 10% of the United States? 15% of the United States? And yet, if I had a casual conversation with a gal in the parking lot on any given day and said, how you doing financially, what's the answer going to be?
Wish I had a little more.
Just want a little more. Just getting by. Just doing the best we can. Making good decisions with what we got. But boy, it would be nice if, you know, it's a little tight. It's a little tight. That might be the expression. It's a little tight. So from the perspective of, is this one of the best of times? Yes, it is, especially comparing ourselves to the rest of the world. Maybe not comparing ourselves to South County. But is it also the worst of times? So I grabbed some stats to kind of make this point. About 60% of the United States homes have less than $1,000 in savings. So all they got to have is the freezer go out, and they're dead in the water. 80% of us, again, the United States, have some form of debt. 80%. Some form of debt. Could be car, could be house, could be credit cards, could be student loans, some form of debt. The average household in our country carries just under $16,000 of credit card debt. And a mortgage of about $175,000 a year. Or $175,000, period. Not a year. Student loans, this is a big relatively recent concept in the last 10 years, the amount of student debt for those same people is about $46,000. Now, credit card debt, interestingly enough, ebbs and flows based on the age of the consumers. Baby boomers, ours is about $7,000. We're talking about credit card debt. We're in debt with our credit cards, my generation, of about $7,000. Gen Xers, our kids, are at about 82. More than. Not less than. More than. Now, the millennials are getting, really ranked up about credit card debt. And they've cut it almost in half. They're a little over 4,000. 4,800, actually. So depending on the age of the consumer, their view of credit card debt is entirely different. Now, the average American household carries $131,000 worth of debt. Mortgage, cars, credit cards, student loans, the whole shenanigan. $131,000. That's a lot of debt. If you made, as a household, $200,000, and you had $131,000 worth of debt, that's a lot of debt to manage. You know, that's not just credit card payment to credit card payment. Bankruptcies are exceeding over $1 million a year. And as you and I both know, healthcare costs are just out of sight. So it is the best of times in that we are earning more money proportionately than anyone else in the world, and certainly any other time period in the world. So it's best in that sense. It's the worst of times because we are indebted up to our eyeballs in just so many different ways. There's not a person in this room that could not eat today anything they darn well wanted. If you wanted to walk out and go have, what would be the top of the line? Steak and lobster, maybe? I don't know. Anyway, there's none of us that if we really wanted it, couldn't walk out and go have steak and lobster. That's the best of times. The worst of times is we're probably not going to pay cash. And therefore, we are perpetuating a cycle of indebtedness. I was thinking about this a few generations back. If you couldn't pay your debts, you became an indentured slave, right? So if you couldn't pay the guy who owned whatever it was, you ended up working for the guy. You were no longer independent. You no longer had choices. You couldn't sell your crops anywhere you wanted to at any price you wanted to. You were indebted to somebody. And, you know, we all crow about that we are free Americans. We get to do what we want to do. But think about that just for a moment. Are we not indentured slaves to something? Either Wells Fargo, American Express, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Citicorp. Don't they control us? If we're so indebted, either on the mortgage side, the student loan side, the credit card side, and a thousand other ways that we indebt ourselves, aren't we indebted to them? Do we have freedom to look at our kids and say, yeah, we're going to Dubai this summer? No, we got to pay off X or Y or Z. Freedom is when we don't owe anyone anything. And interestingly, that is a biblical principle. So let's look at some of the Bible principles. I think this is a good place to start the discussion about finances. So I put them in different categories. I think I had about five categories. Yeah, I do. What is the focus of our minds as it relates to finances? What are some of the concerns in terms of the challenge of finances? What does the Bible have to say about debt? What does it have to say about giving? And what does it have to say about saving? So I just put all the verses here so we didn't have to spend all day looking them up, but I want to talk about them individually. So our focus. So what's our focus regarding money and finances? Matthew 6, verse 24. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Pretty plain. So if we're indebted up to our eyeballs, who are we serving? Money. Every choice we make will be reflected off of the constraints of money. If we're not indebted and maybe all we got is two pennies left, but we're not indebted. There is a freedom to choose how to spend those two pennies. It may only be two pennies, I'm granting that. But nonetheless, we cannot serve one and, or excuse me, serve both. We end up serving one or the other. And I'm going to say to you that in our culture, we've defaulted to serving money. We're only tipping at best God. He's getting a little bit of our time and attention, a little bit of our finances, a little bit of our perspective. But generally speaking, money consumes a whole lot more. Think of the decisions that you've made in the last, and I know I'm meddling, and last week, gosh, come on guys, you were meddling all over me. It's only fair that I get a chance to meddle at you. But at any rate, you know, you think about the last 20 years of major decisions you've made in life. You guys all been married for 20 years? How long have you guys been married, Susan?
25.
Okay, so you're outside my bubble, but we'll keep you in. So let's go back 25 years then. So for the last 25 years, you've made a decision who to marry. You probably made a decision on careers, one or both of you. You probably made a decision on purchases, house, no house, cars, no cars, whatever. Children, no children, how many children, all those, right? We call those major decisions. How many of those were influenced by finances? You know, probably who to marry, maybe not. Although, if you go upstairs and ask the girls who they want to marry, what are they going to tell you?
A rich
man.
Maybe not a rich man, but someone at least is stable.
Yeah, but define stable.
Has a job.
We're lowering our standards up here. We're down to just has a job. Upstairs, it would be rich. Downstairs, I got a job. Okay. Did not which house you buy have much to do with finances?
Sure.
Much. Car, even the choice to have children or more than one child. Didn't finances come into that discussion? It does in most modern relationships. So the Bible is saying you can't serve two masters. You're either going to put God on the throne and everything trickles down from there, or you're going to have a reflection where finances are a primary consideration in your decision making. Second verse I wanted to show to you is Matthew 6:1. Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. My point there was, in our focus of choices of what we do, sometimes when we are a giver, our motive is triggered by how we might be perceived by other people, which is why the Bible talks a lot about giving anonymously, not with your name or who you are attached to it. Psalm 37, look at this one. Better the little that the righteous have than the wealth of many wicked, for the power of the wicked will be broken, but the Lord upholds the righteous. Better the little that the righteous have than the wealth of the wicked. If I were anonymously to send a little piece of paper around and say, describe for me in your marriage your happiest moment. Pick a moment, a time period, a few days, a week, a month, I don't care. But you pick a slice and describe it to me. Tell me what it's like. I will lay you money, even though we shouldn't bet money, I would lay you money that you're going to pick a time when you had very little. You were distracted by very little. You're not going to pick the big house that you might be living in now. You're going to pick some beat-up old apartment that you barely could make the rent in. You had a busted-down couch, and maybe you were still sleeping on a futon on the floor. I don't know. Or you were still in college, and you know the big night out was two straws and a milkshake, right? It's interesting to me that we identify those highlighted moments in our lives, and they almost never have anything to do with money. Better the little than the wealth of many. 1 Timothy 6, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant or to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides with everything for our enjoyment. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant or to put their hope in wealth. our culture is so centered on that our hope for a meaningful life is found in what we own and what we have. And it's so distorted. It's so unhealthy. It's so, Money is an opportunity to do something, positively or negatively, for yourself, for your family, for others. But this scripture is trying to make sure that we understand that very often the accumulation of wealth changes the heart or the attitude of the person. I had a chance this morning to do a little video for a friend of mine who's having a birthday. And one of their kids asked me to do a little video and wish him a happy birthday. And I was thinking about the character qualities of this person. And if I were picking out somebody that was rich, he'd probably be in my top, I don't know, three or four. I don't know what their family, but they got lots. It has zero to do with this person. And when I went to talk about their life, it didn't even enter my mind that where they live or resources or anything else. It had all to do with that person's character. You know, it is very easy when we have lots of resources for it to affect our character, how we see ourselves. And therefore, we become arrogant. Our hope is supposed to be in God, not in our resources. Whatever those resources are. For some, it's not money. Sometimes the resources is their personal abilities. What I'm capable of doing on my own. I used to have a verse on my desk. It's not the current one right now. But it used to be on my desk. It talked about, you know, some hope in horses. There's a passage that talked about some hope in horses, but we hope in our God. And the idea was the leader that is reflecting and only realizing or not realizing, but leaning on their own abilities, that one's in trouble. Versus the one that says, wait a minute, my hope as a leader is in God, not in my resources, my abilities, my mind, my background, my experience. It's the same thing with money. The opposite of being arrogant is being humble. And that doesn't happen very often with people of great means. The last verse I put down under our focus is in 1 Samuel. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. There have been periods in my life when I had plenty. There have been other periods in my life when I didn't have two nickels to rub together. In both cases, the Lord was sovereign. The trick is to be able to be the same person whether you had much or very little. If we change based on our resources, then there's something wrong. If there is a heart of generosity when you got two nickels to share one nickel with the other guy, then that attitude needs to prevail when you got a million. If your home is a respite for your neighbors and your friends, and they can come in at any hour and any time and share beanie weenies or whatever you're having for dinner, or, oh no, we have to have it catered. The one is who you are. The other is, well, wait a minute. My money now suggests that we should have a catered dinner. No. I realize Beanie Weenies might not be your choice. Fine. A nice chicken dinner. That would be lovely. But see my point? The focus on money is supposed to be different for the child of God. Now, what's the challenge? Look at 1 Timothy 6:10. Here's the challenge about it all. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Have you not made, or am I the only one in the room that's ever made, a decision having to do with a purchase that caused you to be grieving later? You know, the love of money is the root of all evil, not the love of money. Money is not the root of all evil. It's the love of money. That friend that I was doing that birthday thing for has oodles of resources. You would never, ever know it. there's no love of money in that family. It's like turning the tap on. There's a resource. There's water. Yeah, fine. You flush the toilet. Water goes through it. You do this with money. You do that with money. There's no love of money. Money is not the problem. It's the love of money. It's whether money sits in an open hand or it sits in clenched fists. It's not how much is in there. If you and I lived in northern Bangladesh, there's nothing, nothing. We're hoping for a few grains of rice to feed our kids. It's not how much is in there. It's how clenched are our fingers. The love of money is the root of all evil. And some people eager for money have wandered because their focus gets off. It's the more and more. I just need a little more. I just need a little more. I just need a little more. How much is enough? More. A little more. Look at Ecclesiastes 5:10. Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. This too is meaningless. If I send a survey around every parent in Stony Brook and said, are you satisfied with your income? How many yes boxes do you think would be checked? It's not good. You know, the problem is it's insidious. There never is enough. Because at the moment that we have a few more resources, we raise our standard of living. Then we get some more resources, a few more resources, and what do we do with that little margin? We fill it with another standard of living. So we're down here and we buy our first little house and we are absolutely delighted. This little two-bedroom, hole-in-the-wall, whatever. It's the greatest thing since sliced bread. You couldn't wait to go out there and paint it yourself, right? And whatever your mortgage was, you know. And so you or he or both of you, your standard of living began to rise. And so you had a few more resources. So what happened to this really cute, lovely, incredible little two-bedroom fixer-upper? Well, we really need that three-bedroom. And we probably did. We had kids. We got to put them somewhere. I get it. I'm not making fun of that part. But, you know, okay, so now we got this really cool little three-bedroom Mission Viejo. It is terrific. It's got a garage and everything. It's really good. You know, and so standard of living goes up a little bit. And what happens to our needs? Well, that three-bedroom, I mean, goodness, you know, we got some equity in that baby. We could probably go to Ladera. Let's go to Ladera. Yeah. Okay, so now we're on Ladera. Now I'm making everybody that lives in Ladera mad at me. I'm an equal opportunity slammer, so I'm going to go to Coda now. Next. So, you know, you go up, you get a little bit more standard living, and then you Ladera with those silly little cul-de-sacs, and then you're going to Coda. I don't know what's after Coda. I don't know. Whatever. We do this, do we not? We do that. Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. This, too, is meaningless. Yes.
Okay. I'm
not even halfway through my lesson here, but no. Go ahead.
How do we then apply this to business? For example, Stony Brook started out small. And then you have to make a little money then to be able to expand and grow. And then you spend more money and you expand and grow. And you have to spend more money because you need more room. So you're always spending more. But it's also for something great. So
but the difference is one is the building of a business. The other is the building of a life. I'm suggesting to you there's a difference.
Okay.
I'm not talking about your husband building his business as an attorney. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about those of you that are self-employed and you're trying to make a living doing X or Y or Z. I'm talking about the difference between our attitude about amassing wealth or amassing finances or being so focused on money that we forget that we're building a life. Hold that thought. Maybe it'll be a little clearer in a minute. Revelation 3, verse 17. You say, I'm rich. I have acquired wealth and I do not need a thing. But Jesus, he's the one that's standing at the door knocking in that passage. You do not realize that you are wretched and pitiful and poor and blind and naked. I often think about this when I go by the guy at Costco with the little sign up. We all kind of look at him with a hmm after we evaluate his tennis shoes to decide whether he's worthy or not to give money to. But after we do that, we kind of look down our noses at him because he's, if I could use the biblical phrase, wretched and pitiful and poor and blind and naked. And I often wonder what would happen if God took an inciting, you know, little scoper deal, and he turned it from the guy on the corner with the little cardboard sign and put it at the lady that's walking into Costco. How many of us are wretched and pitiful and poor and blind and naked because our priorities are so messed up? This guy might be down to his last two nickels, may or may not be, but from appearances appears to be. But the gal walking right by him into Costco is equally as pitiful or wretched or poor or blind or naked once you peel away the externals. So the biblical challenge here is to have things but not let things have us. To have things but not let things have us. Another way of looking at that is to own things and not let them own us. One of the reasons the campus in Ladera didn't work is because we wrongly had a business plan that said, hey, this area is going to go crazy with kids, and they will be thrilled to put them into private school. The place went crazy with kids, but at one time was the nation's number one location for foreclosures. Because everybody, you know, sold their soul to get into those homes with a high homeowners association and tax extra tax layers and all the things that are true about homes in Ladera. Yeah, there were tons of kids, but they were house rich and very poor. No ability to do private school. Our culture tends to be that way. So the challenge is to not let things own us. We own things. They don't own us. Let's talk a little bit. Yep.
A lot of times there are statistics around like Christian behavior versus not Christian behavior. When you looked at all of those numbers for like debt and student loan and this and that, was there any difference at all between people that call themselves Christians versus not in the numbers?
To be honest, I did not do any real looking at that. I would wager a guess that there's not much difference. I would wager that guess based just on my 35 years of watching here. I review scholarship applications as part of the committee, and I look at the indebtedness there. I would say it's pretty consistent with the stats, but I did not. I make a guess that there's not a whole lot of difference. Let's talk about debt. What does the Bible have to say about debt? Romans 13:8, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. Now, I will grant you that the context for that verse is not necessarily financial, but I think the principle applies. Let no debt remain outstanding. It's not a healthy environment to be indebted. It's just not. To the extent we can avoid it, so much the better. Proverbs 22, verse 7, the rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is slave to the lender. That's the principle. We are slaves to our lenders. We can't give away $200 to the missionary who showed up on Sunday because we got to make a credit card payment this month. And, you know, it's 28%, and otherwise we won't have a credit card in our pocket to do what we want to do next month. And so we are limited in our ability to respond. Because what happens is the borrower becomes slave to the lender. If you don't owe anybody anything, you're in a different position to deal with your finances. Now, in a modern context, you're not going to walk out of here today, make an unbelievable decision, I will owe no man nothing, and by noon be debt free. It ain't going to happen. But you can make decisions to limit that. You can look at things like mortgages, and make decisions about where we live based on how much we want to be a slave to someone. Now, since last week I was such a pathetic example of the not-so-good stuff, I get to brag about something that I might be half-decent at. And so here's an example about this debt thing. So, a few years back, when I was starting to contemplate that I would not always be the head of school at Stony Brook, my basic plan was, Barb and I owned a home, a big home in Ladera, or in Laguna Niguel. Never lived in Ladera. Anyway, in Laguna Niguel. And it had five bedrooms. It was this huge house, five-bedroom house, because her mom lived with us for a while, and Brianna was there, and blah, 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 we needed this big house. So, you know, Grandma passes away, Brianna moves on, graduates, moves on, or didn't graduate, but moves on, blah, 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 blah. We're down to two old ladies rattling around this big house. This is not good. Moving into retirement age, say, what are we going to do? So my basic plan was sell the house, split the equity. I'm going to probably Alaska. I just thought I'd really like it up there. And Barbara's going to stay here because all the family, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. Boy, you're getting old, great-grandchildren. But anyway, great down here. And so that was the plan. So along that time frame, you know, so then the discussion starts coming. We had about, do you care if I use numbers?
Oh, you're running wild.
The record record, she said she didn't mind. So anyway, we had about $500,000 in equity in that house. So the idea was, okay, you have $250,000, I have $250,000, we're going to go settle ourselves for the last third of our lives. So the discussion started to be, what could you buy in South Orange County for $250,000? I was okay, because in Sitka, Alaska, $250,000 buys you a palatial mansion. But not so much in her case. Anyway, lots of discussions, and so along the lanes, someone mentioned to us a friend. We ended up seeing a friend who lived in a mobile home park in San Clemente. I made a crack on one of the trips we were making, looking at various places where one or both of us might want to live. I would never live in a mobile home, never, never, never. So anyway, we're having this exchange with this family that their mother was in a mobile home, and a series of conversations, and suddenly, this is how my mind started working. We could sell the big house, go buy the land. There's not very many places where mobile home parks let you buy the land. There's only three in Orange County. You buy the land, buy a piece where the thing is just falling apart, haul it off, go down to the factory, specify how you want a house built, have the house built, have it brought, put on the land, landscape it, hardscape it, and put money in the bank savings, and for the rest of our lives, our total indebtedness for taxes, insurance, utilities, Wi-Fi, and everything is $400 a month. And that's what we did. So for the rest of my life, I can live... And it's a little under 1,900 square feet home that was specified exactly. Walls, windows, door handles, everything was specified as if it was a spec home. And my total indebtedness for the rest of my life is less than $400 a month. Now, I'm in a position to stay in South Orange County as a retired woman, having worked in ministry my entire life, have money in the bank to cover the air conditioner when it breaks down, and on a monthly basis, reach in here and go, gee, Lord, what would you like me to do with it? Now, that's probably the one and only decision I've ever made in my life that reflects these principles of margins. But I offer it to you to say that there is a truth that comes, the freedom that comes from those kinds of decisions. You're not going to get out of debt in terms of mortgages and serious kinds of debt overnight. Like most people, there was a point, you know, 10, 15 years ago when I looked at my credit card statement and said, this stinks. At the end of the year, I figured it out, I'm going to pay them $912 for the right to use this stupid card. And I cut it up. And I ended up settling on, in my particular case, happened to be an American Express card. And you know why I chose it? It's because they give me no latitude. I have to pay that stinking payment every month. It forced me to be a good manager of my money and limit my debt. And over a period of time, I got to the place where I had no credit card debt. Having sold the big house, I have no mortgage debt. my car is paid off about the same time as I retire. I will have no car debt. All of that was planned because I want in my last third to have some freedom. It doesn't happen overnight. But debt has to be addressed if you're going to create a financial margin. Let's look at another principle. The principles regarding giving. Matthew 19:21, Jesus answered and said, if you want to be perfect, here's what you do. You go and you sell your possessions and you give it to the poor and you will have treasure in heaven. All right, so who's going to go out and do that today? Who's going out? We're going to Crown Valley. Pick out somebody. Handy pink slip at the back of the car. Hand him the pink slip. Invite him over to the house. Sign off the house. Is this happening? Probably not. But if you want to be perfect, that's what you do. The principle is, don't let the possessions own you. Sell them. Limit them. Cut them back. Make them manageable. Be reasonable. You got to live somewhere. And in South County, it's not going to be $100 a month. Let's live in the real world. But it doesn't have to be, whoo. It could be, whoo. You know? Malachi 3:10, bring the whole tithe into the storehouse. The word tithe simply conveys the idea of a tenth. It's a numeric number. And in the Old Testament, that was a starting place. May I please emphasize, New Testament Christians like to say, well, I tithe, net, not gross. Wait a minute. The tithe, a 10% number, was a beginning point in the Old Testament. Real good Jewish men who were really, really giving the way they should were somewhere up in the 40% because they had other offerings that went on top of their basic tithe. There was a period of time in my life when I was first doing consulting when I was rolling in money. I mean rolling in money. I owned nothing. I didn't have any debt of any kind. I was just making a boatload of money. And my particular church presented new missionaries every month. And I was just adding the missionaries to my giving. They get $100 too. Yeah, they get $100 a month too. Yeah, they get a. And at one point I stepped back and looked and I went, you know what? I'm giving away 50, 60% of my income. I'm still rolling in money. When there's plenty, you give it away. That's the idea. It's not a matter of amassing. What's the principle, the guy who keeps planting so many fields that he can't store it all, so what does he do? He builds more barns. No. No more barns. The principle is give it away. So breathe the whole tithe in the store so there may be a food in my house. You know, pastors hate to talk about money. They're crazy. Money is the dipstick to my heart. How I act when we are talking about money tells me something about my heart. I'm watching all your faces. And the ones that are full face looking at me go, oh yeah. I got you. The ones that's looking down, you're like, shut up, Sherry. I don't want to talk about money. It's a little focus into your character. It is, guys. Money's that way. The whole idea here is that our churches ought to have an abundance because we have an abundance. Well, not really, sure. Have you seen our finances? Yes, I understand the current state of affairs may not have a lot of abundance. But with a few decisions and a little bit of time, we could be in a better situation. And he's saying, if you bring the tithe into the storehouse, then I'm going to throw open the floodgates of heaven and I'm going to pour out so much blessing that there will be no room enough to store it. We don't need more barns. It's just going to keep coming. The most generous people I know have the happiest, most satisfied, fulfilled lives. Because it just keeps coming. And I don't just mean money. But that's certainly a resource. Exodus 22:25 says, if you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, do not treat it like a business deal. Charge no interest. Even if I loan something to somebody, I shouldn't charge a reasonable interest. I mean, it doesn't have to be 28%, but how about 22%? What happened to the, you got a need, I got some resources that can help you out? Loan it to you. Just loan it to you. I don't need to make anything on the deal. Just loan it to you. Luke 12, sell your possessions and give to the poor. Oh, yeah, there's a hot idea. So we'll just start in the back right-hand corner. We'll get a little list going of everything you're just going to, you know, donate this week, and we're going to sell it and give it to the poor. What if we did make a list like that? At my house, it's the green couch in the family room because I don't like it anyway. I'm not giving you my brown chair. Green couch, maybe, but not my brown chair. Sell your possessions. Give it to the poor. Provide purses for yourselves that will not wear out. It's a treasure in heaven that will never fail, where no thief will come in and no moth destroys. We spend so much time trying to control and protect our wealth. And I'm not saying that common sense shouldn't prevail. I'm not saying you shouldn't have a financial advisor and you shouldn't sit down and have good, detailed, common sense conversations with and plan for the future. I think that's an intelligent, appropriate thing for godly people to do. I'm just saying if our standard of living was down here, there'd be stuff left over to give away. Matthew 6:1, verse 4. Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you'll have no reward from your fathers in heaven. So when you give to the needy, don't announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets to be honored by others. Truly, I tell you, they've received already their reward in full. When you give to the needy, don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing, so that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. I love playing Santa Claus. It's one of my favorite tasks in Stony Brook. When somebody here has got a problem or challenge, and somebody else comes up and says to me, Sherry, I'd really like to give, you know, some finances to, you know, Susie. They're in trouble. Robert's not worked in it, you know, 6 months. And I'd like to just slip them this $100. Can you get it to them? Yeah, you bet I can. I love it. Hey, Susie, you know, Lord wanted you to have this $100. Where'd it come from? Pretty cool, fun thing to do. That's one of the principles regarding giving. The last one I gave you is in Matthew 5. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. I was walking down the streets of Seoul, Korea one day with a missionary friend, and a bunch of little street urchins came up and were clamoring all over us. And I really enjoy it when people clamor all over me physically. Oh, she's my favorite. Love it. Love it. Especially when they do it in a language I can't understand and they're touching me and really like it. But it became clear to me pretty quickly that what they were doing was trying to get money. And so at that point, my attitude was, if I can't evaluate your real need, you ain't getting a nickel. And my missionary friend responded to them in Korean and started reaching into his pockets, getting everything he got. And he was dumping coins out in every little kid's hand that he had. He ran out of coins, and so he goes for his wallet, and he starts taking money out of his wallet and putting it in the kid's hands, and then puts his wallet away. I will never forget standing there on that street corner. I turned to him, and his first name is Joe. I said, Joe, what are you doing? You know nothing about those kids. He said, Sherry, my giving has nothing to do with them. Nothing. I neither know about their need nor care. They asked me. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Now, I failed a few times, but since that time, my attitude has been, you ask me, you're getting some.
Good to know.
I think I got about $23 in my wallet. You're welcome to it. It's not our job to evaluate the worth of the recipient. It's not my job. Do I think I get taken to the cleaners? Sure. You betcha. And I kind of get a kick out of trying to analyze that a little bit after I give. You know, there was a gal on the corner the other day at Chick-fil-A, and she had a sign, and I don't remember what it said, but I remember trying to check out how old the sign was, and, you know, was it folded in a certain way. I love the analytical part of it for me. But the bottom line is, you ask me, you're going to get some money from me. So, principles about giving. Lastly, principles about saving. Proverbs 13, verse number 11. Dishonest money dwindles away, but whoever gathers money little by little makes it grow. Nothing in the world wrong with saving. and having a strategy and a plan, and maybe having an advisor that can help you do that. You are asked to gather money little by little and make it grow. The issue is, make it grow for what? You know, if it's just to make it grow for the accumulation so I can buy another barn, not so. And then Proverbs 10:4, dishonest money dwindles away, but whoever gathers money little by little makes it grow. So saving is a biblical principle. Now, there are some great Christian people who do all kinds of work in finances. Pardon me. There's some wonderful organizations. If you're struggling in the area of finances, I highly recommend, I'll give you a couple of references. Go online. They've got stuff that you can do online. You can go to conferences. You can go to the resources are all available for you. I'm not trying to be that person. Yes?
That one duplicated. Do you want the 10-4?
Yeah, what does 10-4 say? Oh, you're right. It did do good.
Lazy hands make for poverty, but diligent hands bring wealth.
Perfect. That's even better. So cross out the dishonest money one and put the right verse 10, or chapter 10, verse 4. Thank you so much, Anna. Anyway, my point is I'm not trying to be the end-all of financial planning for you and your family. But I do want to make just some suggestions that would help you restore financial margins. The first suggestion is settle once and for all the issue of lordship in your family and in your personal life. Who is Lord of you? Do kingdom principles rule? Yes or no? Now, we're all going to fail. We're going to say yes right this minute, 10 minutes from now, not so much. I get that. But as it relates to direction, our family, my family, my finances, we're headed this direction. I am putting Christ on the throne of our money. I am going to invite him to have conversations regularly with what we have and how we spend it. Even that would be an amazing beginning. When was the last time you and your husband sat down at the beginning of the year and prayed over your family budget? Or prayed about the income, or how you should spend, or who you should give to, or why, or how? So once and for all, settle the issue of lordship. Philippians 2:10, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God. Once we establish that, once we seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, then all these other things will be added unto you. Let that be a specific point in your life, a specific point in your marriage. Go away for a weekend. Honey, I want to talk about money and God. Highlight. Can't wait. Choose somewhere he really likes to have that conversation. Seriously, though, it's an issue of lordship. It's so much easier when that's settled. When you've decided who's the owner, I'm not the owner. I'm the steward. Now, I'm a mouthy steward. I'm a mouthy steward. I got an idea. And with regularity, God has to rein me back in and say, that's lovely, Sherry, and when I need it, I'll ask you for it. But who's the owner? Who's in charge? Where's God? Is he the Lord of my finances? So big deal. Second one, vow, once you settle that issue of lordship, you're going to swim against the culture. Because guys, the wave is unbelievable. Your kids are not swimming against the stream. They're going with the flow. They just are. It takes a monumental effort. As for me and my house, we're swimming this way. Whether it has to do with what we wear, what we drive, where we go on vacation, what we own. Just that turn against the grain is very difficult. Very difficult. So healthy, though, guys. To whatever extent, even if you only get it this far over, it's so much better than just getting knocked down with it. And maybe it'll come in, you know, sections. You make that far, okay? And you make another, and in a different season, you make another, and another season, you make another. Doesn't happen overnight. But Joshua 24 talks about, you know, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. Many of our homes have that hanging in the kitchen somewhere, that little plaque. Except we should put a little note that says, except for finances. As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord with everything except our money. Boy, did I go to meddling today, didn't I? See, you made me feel so bad last week. I just had to come at you this week. Anyway, the third one is determined to, I called it, live within your harvest. If we were living in an agrarian society, and I owned, you know, 50 acres, and you owned 50 acres, and I'm raising corn, and you're raising, I don't know, peas or something. I ain't raising peas, so maybe corn. My harvest comes in, I got, you know, X number of bushels of corn. That's what I'm living off of next year. Is however many bushels of corn I got, that's what I'm living off next year. There's no making it up. I got X number of bushels of corn, we're living off of that this year. Somewhere along the line, we got the idea that's not necessary. So what we do is we live off of that and everything I can talk you into loaning me. So the guy that had a little extra, he got 50 barrels of whatever, but he only needed 40. He's got 10 to loan. And he loans 5 to me and 5 to her. Now we owe him. Now my crop is not my own. I've not lived within my harvest. Now in a practical way, how does that affect us? It affects us by learning to know the difference between needs and wants. My wonderful assistant, Monet, came in. She is the most amazing woman on the face of the earth, I tell you what. And she is growing spiritually like leaps and bounds. And she came in and she said something about she was going to go to In-N-Out with her daughter. And she said it was a fun bit of negotiation. I said, well, why didn't you negotiate? I know you both like In-N-Out. She said, because for Lent, I chose to give up anything that wasn't a necessity. So I'm not spending one dime during the 40 days of Lent that isn't an absolute necessity. There are no wants being spent of any kind. And so I got to thinking about that. What an incredible thing to do. So the In-N-Out thing was, the daughter said, can we go to In-N-Out tonight? And she said, is that in want or a need? And the kid said, I need to eat. Exactly. And she said, and we have plenty of leftovers in the refrigerator. And so then the kid said, if I pay, can we go to In-N-Out? And she said, I'd love to. What if we did that in our whole lives? Is this a need or a want? Nothing wrong with having some wants. Nothing. It's just that a little delayed gratification wouldn't kill us. Having a want and working towards it makes the arrival of that much more sweet. But the kid who gets everything the instant they want it, there are no satisfactions. There is one value. I want it, I get it, done. Did you not as a child have something you wanted? You had to earn it, save for it? My savings went into a sock when I was little. And I'd take that sock and dump it out on my bed, count up those quarters, count up those nickels, working towards whatever it was I wanted. When I finally got it, when I could go spend my sock, I was thrilled out of my mind. And that item I got, I took a whole lot better care of than something that was just given to me. We don't live in that culture, and our kids are not living in that culture. So the principle is, you know, live within your harvest. Make a budget and stick to it. Emphasize usefulness over things like fashion or culture or whatever the latest and greatest is. You know? Needs and wants. I told you when we moved, we had a thing going where once we moved into the smaller house, we can't put all of our stuff in there, so we had to make some value judgments about what, only so much stuff can go in closets and so forth. So then the principle was, if you buy something new, you got to replace it. So if you get a new mug, a new coffee mug, you got to go give one away, throw it away, take it to Goodwill or something, but one mug's got to go. You can't just keep adding coffee mugs or t-shirts or Christian or kitchen appliances. You got to sell one, give one, take it down to Goodwill, something. Live within your harvest. The next one is decrease your spending. The easiest way to do that is just cut up your stinking credit cards. Or go down to one. Pick one the color you like. Doesn't matter. The one that has the picture of your dog on it. Keep that one. You know, limit the size of your mortgage. Say, we're willing to spend X number of our income for a mortgage. Now, here's where, you know, industry standards do have a play. They are suggesting that you should not spend more than 28% of your monthly income against a mortgage. 28%. And all other forms of debt thrown in, it should not swell beyond, some groups say 35, others say 40% of your income. You should have 60% of your income unencumbered. Decrease your spending. Eliminate debt. You know, one at a time. Pick the credit card that's got the highest percentage of whatever and target that. Make a double payment. Start making double payments until you can get it paid off. But start with cutting it up, because otherwise you're gonna circle back around. So cut it up, throw it away, and then start making double payments against that one. You get that one done, check. Move to the next one. Decrease your spending. Increase your income. Now this one's tricky because we don't have much trouble chasing after increasing our income in our culture. But I wrote down for a season with a specific financial goal in mind, consider working more hours or a second job or starting a home business. But for a very specific purpose with a very specific time frame. Because otherwise what happens is we just go, oh, we need to work more and harder. And so a husband who's only home, you know, 9 o'clock at night now, we say to him, hey, hon, we need to increase our income. So pick up another client and stay till 10 o'clock. No. That violates all kinds of other principles. But, you know, for a season with a specific financial goal in mind, you know, consider working either more hours, a second job, starting a home business, helping a friend out with something that you could be paid for, but increase income. And the next one is increase savings. That requires us to develop a lifestyle of a deferred gratification. I don't have to have it right now. Learn to wait for the blessing. Learn to wait. But I really, 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 really want the bigger TV for the March Madness. The three TVs that I have at my disposal are quite fine, thank you. And if I really, 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 really wanted a bigger TV, I could start saving for it. When I get it, boy, am I going to appreciate it. James chapter 5, verse 7 and 8 says, be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and the spring rains. You too be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. It's the idea of learning to wait. We don't like to wait. I want it, and I want it now. Psalms 27, wait for the Lord, be strong and take heart. Wait for the Lord. So what's my bottom line? My bottom line is that margins in our finances will create a little breathing room. And that little breathing room reduces stress and friction in the home. My guess is out of the last 10 fussings you had with your husband, 8 of them had some root in finances. That'd be my guess. Maybe not, but I wouldn't be surprised. If we can reduce the stress associated with money, we're taking away one more play yard for Satan to do his tap dance in our lives. And we're creating a little capacity. And that capacity allows us to be more generous people. The joy of life is giving time, giving energy, giving resources, giving help, and giving finances. We all know that. The happiest moments of our life are when we're engaged in helping someone else. Now, financially, wouldn't it make sense just to work to get to a place where you had that margin, even financially, to be able to do that? Margins. Important. Let's pray. Lord, this is a tough topic. I suppose all of them are. Some of them hit some people more specifically than others. This is a universal problem, Lord. And it's not one that I have conquered either. I know in my own life, I don't like to wait for things. I want it. I want it now. I know that I'm not as generous as I could be. I know there are a whole host of things that are true that I violate in relationship to creating margins in finances. But I am grateful, Lord, for those lessons learned to date. And I pray for my sisters that they would take this seriously, not just go with the flow, but actually have some meaningful conversations and change some things. Start with something small, but make a change. Because ultimately, Lord, we don't want to be bound to our stuff. We want to be bound to you. Help us to get there. I pray it in Christ's name. Amen.